Case number 21-3755, Andrew Stevens et al. Versus the City of Columbus, Ohio et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Thompson, you may proceed for the appellant when you're ready.
Have you reserved your rebuttal time?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, my name is Maurice Thompson. I'm here for the Stevens family, and we would typically not bring a zoning or land use dispute or anything resembling an appeal to this court, but this is no ordinary zoning or land use type case. This case is ultimately about whether, in tension with due process, a municipality may delegate total dominion over private yards by banning any exterior change to untrained and non-expert private volunteers to whom the homeowner must prove that his or her landscaping is compatible and face prison, seizure of the home itself, and confiscatory fines, even when there is no historic architecture at issue and no common law nuisance and nothing more but landscape deemed too suburban looking by those private volunteer non-experts.
Let me ask you about that last point about private volunteer non-experts. Is there not some process, though, through which their decision can be appealed to a politically accountable body?
No, there is not, Your Honor. And I think the answer, that's a good question, and the answer is several parts. First, yes, the decision can be appealed to Board of Commission Appeals. However, the Board of Commission Appeals are also non-governmental actors, and they apply an abuse of discretion standard to the Historic Resource Commission's findings. So they defer on factual findings, and they don't consider the law. And then while many ordinances like this would allow for perhaps an appeal to City Council, that's not the case here. So there's no politically accountable actor ever involved in the process. And equally important,
how do the people get on the Board of Commission Appeals?
They're appointed by the mayor.
So isn't the mayor ultimately politically accountable for what happens on this board?
Well, these individuals are they're not removable, and there's no direct level of accountability other than once the mayor appoints, and there's no external controls.
They're accountable to the mayor, aren't they? They're accountable to the appointing authority.
There's no process for the mayor to remove them or anything along those lines. And the other point I want to make.
I'm sorry. So you're saying that this board is appointed for lifetime tenure?
No. They're appointed for discrete terms, and when their terms are up, somebody else can be appointed.
And they're appointed by a politically accountable entity, the mayor, right?
That's true.
What is your best case law that sort of appointment is inappropriate?
I don't know that I have a case specifically that sort of appointment is inappropriate. I think that one of the issues here is that you farmed out or outsourced a standard that doesn't allow for any sort of review to begin with. And that's the more important point, really, than the nature of the appointment. And what do I mean by that? Well, this HRC, the Historic Resource Commission, has never been overturned by a court. And that's because the standard that it's set to apply here doesn't lend itself to judicial review. So when your standard is compatible.
I'm a little confused about that because I understand what you're saying about the standard. You have some good arguments as to the standard. But the problem here is that your client never even applied for the commission or the board or whatever it is, the historic group, to actually even apply the standard. So really the beef here is not the standard, but it's the fact that your client never applied for a permit.
Your Honor, that's false. The proceedings were as such where the clients landscaped their property and were then issued a notice of violation and an opportunity to apply.
But they never did apply.
No, they did. They did apply.
Oh, they did.
Apply,
but
and they were
apply before.
Correct.
And the requirement, isn't it, clearly it, in the code that you have to, before you undertake the alteration, you have to apply for a certificate of appropriateness.
It is illegal to make any exterior change to your property, any change, prior to getting a certificate of appropriate. So,
as I understand it, to sort of simplify this, it seems to me there are two issues in this case. One is whether the requirement to apply somehow violates the constitutional rights of your client. In other words, could you look at this city ordinance and determine that you have to have an application? That seems to be a no-brainer because it says you got to apply for landscaping. So I want to just put that off to the side, whether you agree with it or not. Once they were cited, they then applied.
Yes.
And here's where I'm most interested in what happened next. There is a process by which you apply, you have meetings, you have hearings, you talk to these unelected people that you're complaining about, and it appears as if it's an iterative process. They tell you, well, we don't like this, but maybe you might be able to do this. And then the way this is set up, because you're supposed to apply before you do the work, then before the work is done, you reach an agreement between the property owner and the city as to what you're going to do. Is that a fair characterization so far?
Well, I don't know that there's any standard procedure. You're definitely correct, Your Honor, that they applied after being told that this requirement existed, which they were unaware of, and then they were then denied because the landscaping was deemed to be too suburban looking.
But let me just finish on that.
Sure.
Because you're missing at least what the import is of the question. They came to this hearing. There was a discussion between the commissioners and your client about what they wanted to do. And essentially, the way I read this process, you look at this in context. The context is not just what the words of the ordinance say, which is what you're focusing on, but it's how it works. And here, you're supposed to meet and try to see if you can reach agreement. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I don't know that sort of bargaining took place if you look at the transcript.
It didn't take place, and that's the whole point. Your client pre-termitted this. He said, look, I'm a lawyer. I hate to play the lawyer card, but if you're telling me I have to remove any of the terracing at all, then I'm going to court. I'm going to sue you. That's in the record.
That something along those lines is in the record.
All right. So what we don't know, and here's the problem, all the city's saying is, look, there's got to be some greenery. There's got to be some grass. There can be some terracing, but not this terracing. And they never got to what terracing and what grass would be approvable because your client quit the process and went to court. So what are we to make of, if you look at this in context, we don't know what the end result would have been. We don't know if there would have been a reasonable compromise that satisfied your client's constitutional rights.
There are two points I want to stress in response to that question. The first is that over a pretty minor issue, landscaping, gardening in your yard, whatever you want to call it, the client attended three separate administrative hearings with the HRC. So there was a lot of deliberation. The client then appealed to the Board of Commission Appeals, and the client then attempted to use the a provision to appeal to the municipal court, but the municipal court said it wouldn't hear the law or the facts on that issue. So I think the client exhausted an extreme amount of administrative remedy for what is just, again, homeowners landscaping, an extreme amount of remedy. And then secondly, there have been multiple times throughout this litigation where the city says, well, just comply. And we say, what does compliance look like? And the city can't tell you because it's outsourced to the Historic Resource Commission. And the Historic Resource Commission has never actually been able to tell the client what compliance would look like. Now, I think the important point here, and I really want to stress the law that I think is helpful on this, and it's this court's 94 decision in Springfield Armory, where the court, and I actually want to quote this, says these vagueness problems are not difficult to remedy because the subject matter does allow for more exactness. This is not a case in which greater specificity would interfere with practical administration. And one of the issues that arose, Your Honor, is that when the client showed up to the Historic Resource Commission, there are all these hidden or surprise concerns that manifest themselves, as you spoke of, you know, the amount of green or the amount of grass or the slope of the art. And all these things could be codified and objectively measured. There's no reason the city can't.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. This Historic Commission system applies to all of the different neighborhoods that have been so designated in Columbus, correct?
Correct.
So it's not just this one, but it's German Village and however many others there are. And each of those different districts have different characteristics. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, Your Honor.
And even within one district, the different streets might look different historically as well. Would that be correct?
There's only one street here, Your Honor, and there's a vast degree of difference amongst the houses on this street, which is part of the
So this historic district is just one street? I thought
that's right.
One street.
The Bryden Road Historic District.
But the point is, you seem to say that compatible in terms of landscaping was susceptible of being spelled out in a way that would then be clear in every single different historical district in the city, however many there are, regardless of the of maybe one is brick German Village, another is Victorian or whatever you may have. I just don't see how you can say that compatibility in the historical context really is even susceptible of being more specific in something like landscaping.
Well, there are two points to that, Your Honor. The first is the factors that the HRC relied upon could be spelled out. And if the factors that you're going to rely upon can't be spelled out, then that is precisely when a standard becomes indiscernible and too vague, when the city can't tell you what it is until you get there. And then you're told you're rejected because, you know, there's too little grass or whatever.
Well, let's say spelling it out is different from one historical district to the other. Is that certainly feasible?
And that could be done, Your Honor, yes.
So in other words, you have to have either different standards for each historical district, or you have to have one standard and then subparts for each historical district.
I believe, for an example, Your Honor, you could simply have one standard that says you can't make an alteration that harms history or that's adverse to history. If historical protection and historical integrity truly is the governmental interest, and we concede readily that that's a legitimate governmental interest, you can simply stop people from transgressing history. You can say no alterations on anything that existed prior to, say, 1900, 1890, whatever the year is. The city can't tell us what the year of history they're trying to preserve here is, and they can't tell us what it looked like then.
I'm struggling with your argument here, not only because it would require an incredible list and sublists that follow from it, but the fact that we're simply here on the failure to apply for a certificate of appropriateness. And my understanding of this record is that your client did apply earlier for another certificate of appropriateness regarding the home and then did not apply in this circumstance. And so if the question of vagueness relates to the application for a certificate of appropriateness, what is vague about 3116.001 that says, or 316.04 that says you must apply for a certificate of appropriateness for any site improvement or architectural feature before you undertake that activity, which was the gist of Judge McKeague's questions?
Yeah.
And that was not done.
Very importantly, Your Honor, that absolutely was done. Once Mr. Stevens was notified that he had landscaped without approval,
but
he did apply for
the
certificate.
Problem,
and he was rejected.
That he had already applied. He knew about the methodology before,
yes,
and did not apply in this circumstance.
Your Honor, he knew that the permits were required for historic architecture and historic homes. He did not know that it applied to yards and landscaping, and when he was told, he immediately followed the city's procedures, and the city commissioners did remark during that hearing that they believed that if he had known of the procedure, he would have applied then before making the permit. So his good faith is not in question here. And then he did apply, despite what the city's brief said, he did apply And that's how the city's process works. You make the change and say, okay, you can apply retroactively, and the standard is you can have your alterations if they are compatible, not if they're historically accurate, but if they're compatible. So the compatibility test really determined whether that application was granted, whether the landscaping stays or not, and whether the penalties apply. So
your time is up. Summarize in one sentence, and then you'll have your rebuttal time.
So what we're seeking here specifically is an injunction against using the denial of the certificate of appropriateness, which was pegged to compatibility, to impose some of the very strict and severe penalties, like the foreclosure action against his home that's pending in municipal court, the excessively high fines, or criminal penalties, which the city says that it intends to impose here.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Laura Baker Morish, and I represent the City of Columbus and Code Officer Timothy Knoll. Going to some of the questions that were coming from the bench regarding the process, I was hoping to address how the City of Columbus HRC members are appointed. As indicated by my opposing counsel, they are in fact appointed by the mayor. They are confirmed by City Council. There is also a provision of the City Charter that allows for their removal. Their removal can occur because of malfeasance, dereliction of duty, your general standard ways of that happening. These members are not an external body that the mayor has tagged with this particular process or task. They, in fact, are individuals that are appointed. Yes, they are volunteer, but as soon as they are appointed, they are provided for and created by and a creature of city code. They function as a public body. They are subject to open meetings. They're subject to public records. They are removable for failure to perform their functions. And, in fact, the city is liable should they, in fact, perform their functions in a manner that isn't against the Constitution. These are not private citizens. These are volunteers who are performing a governmental function and who are doing so with under the specific creation of city code by legislative act of the City Council.
If they're not, am I remembering correctly that there are a there is a distribution of occupations that they that this committee is to have an
That's
architect true. And what is that professional distribution within the committee?
The city code indicates that two of the members should be architects. One of the members should be a member of the Columbus Landmark, I'm going to say society, that might be incorrect, the Columbus Landmark Preservationist. For the other individual members, it's a recommendation that they be architects as well, lawyers, developers, individuals who are involved in historic preservation, public history managers, things along those lines. And there was a specific list within the city code making those recommendations.
Council, could you?
Yes.
I hear what you're saying on this, but I, for me right now, what I'm interested in is knowing what happened once the Stevens family applied for, they were notified that they needed to make this application. They did do the application. And then there started this process. So what was it that led to the breakdown of the process, in your view?
In a couple of different things, Your Honor. I mean, I think the first thing is that once there was an awareness that a notice of violation had been filed, then there is a provision within our code to go back to the HRC, even though you should have gone to them ahead of time. But at that point in time, you're supposed to be working with the commission and with the historic preservationist to assure that whatever landscaping is done is, in fact, compatible with the specific district that you're located in. There was a failure of the meeting of the minds at that point. There are individuals within
the commission want that the homeowners weren't willing to do.
Yes, they were concerned that the specific manner in which it had been built and constructed was not in compliance with the historical accuracy of the area, specifically the tiered nature, the fact that they were using bricks instead of stone or wood, the lack of the sloped lawn that had previously existed at that particular property. These are all characteristic of the Bryden Road District. The idea is that these were homes that were actually built around the turn of the 20th century by individuals who were city council members, commissioners, bankers, architects themselves. I think George Bellows Sr. had a church there. And the idea was these homes were up on a hill and that they had a sloping lawn that then went around the expanse of Bryden Road.
So was it the commission's position then that everything that the homeowners had put in had to be torn out?
I believe that was the position when they could not get any movement on how that might be able to accommodate the changes that they had made.
And is there anything in the record as to how much that would cost?
I do not believe that there is a cost estimate in the record, Your Honor.
Well, part of the problem here is that there wasn't any written findings that were made in terms of the conclusion of the process. So all we have is what the different commissioners said in their dialogue with the appellant in this case. But at one point, as I read it, the sense seemed to be, and tell me whether you think this is wrong, that there needed to be some restoration of a grassy part of this front yard.
Correct.
Right? Now, what the petitioner says is, well, there is grass between the sidewalk and the street. But my understanding is that's not what's at issue here, right?
That's correct.
So I thought the record seemed to, the sense seemed to be, you might be able to leave some of the terracing that you put in, but you're probably going to have to take some of it out and restore some greenery. Is that basically where we are here?
I think, Your Honor, greenery and slope. So I think that if you looked at the other photographs that were actually offered in the record here, you will see that there are some other properties that have some level of either a retaining wall or some sort of tiering, but they maintain that overall view of the sloped nature of that. Some of that's just specifically so the grass doesn't go into the sidewalk.
It's hard to read. It's hard to find what the pictures are in this case because some of the ones that are Google Street View I found to be so blurry you couldn't even read them. But the ones that you could see, all the other houses seemed to have some slope, and oftentimes there was a rock retaining wall that would break that up. But they all had some grass.
Correct. Some grass and some slope.
Is that what we're fighting about here, really, grass?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But there's more to it now. It seems like at least they're saying that you're threatening them with criminal penalties, foreclosure action. What is that all about?
So, Your Honor, in terms of the threatening with the criminal violation, there was a back-and-forth exchange between the appellant in this case and the code officer where the question was specifically asked by the appellant, well, if I don't do anything about this at this point, what could happen? And the code enforcement officer apprised them that there are, in fact, the possibility of criminal penalties, not for not having the grass, but for not having obtained the certificate of appropriateness in the first place and for maintaining it without the certificate of appropriateness. In terms of the action that's pending now in the municipal court, that is an action seeking specifically to bring them into compliance. And while there is
Are you seeking any kind of a penalty or fine as part of that court action?
At this point, no, Your Honor.
When would you seek something?
I can't say that at some point down the line, if we're unable to gain compliance, that we wouldn't then seek other remedies that are available to us. But at this point in time, we are not seeking a fine.
Okay. So you would agree that there may be a future point where you might be seeking the fine, at which time the Stevens, if they have a constitutional defense, could raise it at that point.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But just out of curiosity, if this proceeding that's ongoing in some state tribunal is to bring them into compliance, how does that body determine what compliance is or is not, given that the people that were charged with this responsibility, the Historical Commission, never got to that point?
So the people charged with the bringing them into compliance or giving the certificate of appropriateness ultimately issued a denial, so they did have a final finding and indicated that because they have denied the certificate of appropriateness, then they then have to remove the alterations. They are still willing to work with Mr. Stevens, and they've made that clear, and there's even a mediation process available under the code. But at this point in time, because Mr. Stevens and the appellants have now advanced this as instead a challenge to the constitutionality, we've really kind of gotten away from resolving the problem.
Well, that's what I was trying to ask Mr. Thompson earlier. What is the consequence, if any, on this case pending in federal court, that it appears as if Mr. Stevens pre-termitted the process under the code by rather than going through the iterative process that would have happened had he not made the improvements on his own without the permit to begin with, and then refused to do the mediation that's required or it's called for in the code, and went to court. So what do we make of that?
I think at this point in time, I would direct that to the appellant, but I think he is hoping that this court will issue some sort of an order such that he never has to comply with the certificate of appropriateness requirement. I think his actions at this point are to seek to have it declared unconstitutional such that essentially that will put an end to the process.
And in doing so, that would wipe out all the historical district limitations in the city of Columbus, in addition to just the street that this house is on.
That is correct, Your Honor, at least as I understand it as pertains to landscaping. I believe that the appellant has attempted, and this is an interesting aspect of this particular case, has attempted to argue that it's only unconstitutional as pertains to landscaping, even though the process is exactly the same, whether it be landscaping or changes or alterations to the property itself. That is, again, a very interesting, significant point, because I think it's uncontested at this point that it is not vague to understand that a site improvement requires that certificate of appropriateness. So if that is the only way in which landscaping is different from the code as it applies to buildings, then the question is how could that possibly be that we're only seeking to have it invalidated as to landscaping? And I think the interesting part about that is that Mr. Stevens lives in Brighton District, and there are some benefits to living in a historical district.
So the part of the dispute that's going on here has to do with the walls being brick, but also with black mulch being in all of the areas that were previously grass sloped.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I am not an architect landscaper, and I apologize, but I believe it's no different than the conversations that happened in a number of historical districts regarding the appropriate color of paint to be historically accurate for a home or for an interior. And I believe in this particular case, because Bryden Road, again, is turn of the 20th century, there wouldn't have been black mulch back at that period of time. They were looking for something that would more reflect the historical nature of the street, that would be more in keeping with the homes of that era.
Well, you're more familiar, presumably, with the record than we are. Ignoring houses that might have done landscaping changes prior to this historical code being enacted in the city of Columbus, were there any examples given of other houses that had similar terracing that had been approved by the city?
No. So there were other examples of houses that had similar terracing, but the record doesn't indicate whether or not those specific houses that the photographs were offered to the record were also houses that had received certificates of appropriateness. So we had testimony from Mr. Stevens and his wife regarding photographs that they'd taken from houses in the area, and there was testimony in the record from the historic preservationist regarding the fact that there were about 50 other homes out there that had some level of 50 might be inaccurate, but around 50 terracing. But what there wasn't in the record is kind of an integration of those two ideas or concepts. So that there is nothing in the record to identify any of those particular photographs as being ones that do or do not have a certificate of appropriateness, with one exception, and that was 1606 Brighton Road, I believe.
Well, we see photographs of yards that have some grass, and then generally there's some sort of rock that breaks up the slope, and then there's more grass on the top. Are there any photographs? I couldn't even find any photographs in the record that had straight wall brick terracing like this and no slope left in the yard at all. Are they in the record someplace?
I don't recall seeing one that had bricks. I do recall that there were some photographs that had some much less stark tiers. For lack of again, I apologize for my lack of architectural landscaping. But they maintained the slope because there was, plantings had already overgrown some of it. They weren't as high. They weren't brick. And so in the overall appearance.
Was there some grass in all of those yards?
They all had some level of grass.
Other questions? We thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
So is it true that all the other yards within this district have some grass between the sidewalk and the front of the house?
No, it's not true, Your Honor. We did submit a number of photographs of different homes in the neighborhood. I think page 34 or 37 of our brief has six of those. 1606 Bryden Road, we submitted as very, very similar to this home, but was approved, was given a certificate of appropriateness. So that does happen, and that's one of the issues here, is there is no consistency. Every home is not as it's claimed to be, and that's why we have an as-applied claim, because one of the problems here is when the standard is compatibility, but the home's yards are not all the same, that makes that standard.
There are grandfathered in yards, aren't there?
We don't know, because the city does not know. The city's, the commissioners stated, quote, nobody in their right mind keeps track of those things. So it's impossible for the commission or the homeowners to know which homes are grandfathered in and which are not. And the advice of the city is look around your neighborhood when you're determining what kind of landscaping you can do. And the Stevens did do that, and about 20% of the neighborhood, the uncontroverted testimony is, looks like theirs. And importantly, for that reason, there's no real harm arising. Nobody can be identified that's been harmed by this. This isn't a public health and safety regulation. And
let me ask you about the case law that supports your case. I think there's been some argument under Eubank versus Richmond, a 1912 Supreme Court case. Is that a case you rely on for challenging the vagueness of the standards of review?
Well, the Supreme Court's 74 decision in Eubank is helpful because it just states that when you lend power to some over the private property rights of others, you have to have a discernible standard. And then we looked at what is a discernible standard.
Well,
and the better cases.
What was the standard in that case? Wasn't that a case where on property line decisions, right?
That's right.
Property line decisions were left up to adjacent property landowners with no standards for review whatsoever.
That's right.
Is that not the nature of that case?
Roberge and Eubank, there was no standard. We know that's not okay. And then we know that the functional equivalent of no standard is not okay. And that's this court's decision in Belmar Harbor, where it says reasonable radius around boats when you're breaking the ice is not okay.
And the list of things
light modification
considered that are in this code, you think, you argue, are no standard for review?
The only standard here is compatible or not compatible, and that's squarely within the family of standards that have been invalidated as too vague, like the reasonable radius, the slight modification in Springfield Armory, contemptuous display of the flag that the Supreme Court invalidated, not on First Amendment grounds. Importantly, under the state constitution, the deteriorating area in Norwood is not a standard that could be used to take people's homes, and that standard was even defined by compatible.
We're talking about the code, not the.
Yeah, however, the city does have a lawsuit to take the Stevens property pending right now in municipal court.
That's not what's before us. I think your time's up. Why don't you complete your argument with one sentence? And
thank you. What are squarely before you are the penalties, which include those that the city has already attempted to impose, which is the taking action, the attempt to seize the home for the incompatible landscaping, and also what it has promised it will do in its interrogatory and depositions, which is fines ranging from $100 to $1,000 a day. And we're seeking to enjoin those because the city still cannot tell us what exactly constitutes compliance, has never told us prior to today. This is the most lucid attempt we've heard, and we have attempted to mediate this, but we still don't know what compliance is, and the city is attempting to impose these fines, so we're seeking to enjoin these fines.
Thank you.
Could I ask one other question? I know we're done. I apologize. I looked again at the pictures that are in your brief, and they're helpful because they do show some lawns that appear to have no grass. What the city is saying, as I understand it, is nobody knows whether those were put in prior to this code being enacted or not. So it seems to me we're in this awkward situation where do you determine compatibility based on what places look like before the code came in, or are we just looking at what happened after the code came in? And given that the examples that your client testified to was, I think it was 40 or 50 out of 250 homes, let's just assume for purposes of an extreme example, all of those ones that your client is trying to compare themselves to were done prior to this code becoming effective. So what gets to determine what's compatible? Ones that were prior to the code or only ones after the code from your perspective?
Well, the question is definitely unanswered in the law. And you're getting to the heart of our argument, which is just that half of the HRC members are saying, look, it has to look like other neighbors' homes look today. And the other half are saying, no, it has to look like what it looked like at the time it was built. And by the way, we don't know what it looked like when it was built. We don't know the year it was built. So this compatibility standard invites speculation about what a yard should look like. It invites subjectivity to the point where the final observation is it looks too suburban. So there's not agreement. And that's, you know, this is in the family of loaded terms that don't lend itself to agreement versus if you know, the observations you've made, Your Honor, you know, you've got to have X amount or X percentage of grass. We wouldn't be here if that objective standard were used by the city. And if they had said that at some point, I'm not sure they even said that today or committed to anything. They haven't committed to anything. They had said that, we wouldn't be here today if there were objective metrics. And if those can be used, they should be. If you can't find any objective metrics, then that's the whole point of when a standard becomes too vague. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments. The case will be taken under advisement and an opinion rendered in due course. All of our other cases today are not on oral argument, so you may adjourn court.
The honorable court is now adjourned.